knows about what's going on in the world, because they're looking at so many different issues and whose perspective it's from. And she had no idea that that would be something that would be so rewarding for her, that she had no idea that that was a piece that her child would come away with from coming from an international school.
We frequently hear that our parents will come back and say, our children are watching the news now. I've started watching the news again because my child's watching the news, and I feel like they're getting way ahead of me and knowing what's going on in the world. So we think that's a really great reciprocity that occurs with the education.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Sorry. My name is Sheila Jordan, and I am the superintendent of Alameda County in that very provincial state, but big state, California. There's 18 school districts. We're the intermediary between the state and the school districts. So we have 18 school districts. The largest is probably the most well-known, and that's Oakland, California, and we are across the bay from San Francisco, which is a little better known. But one of the things, and it's very, very diverse, we go from very urban to agrarian out in Livermore, and it's both ethnically and socioeconomically, we cover all the bases. One of the things that the superintendents have decided to do this year is deal with the issue of race, in particular, race and class. Because when you talk about the lack of relevance of testing, there is a reason, certainly in the United States, that NCLB has become the law. And that is because for so many years, children of color, poor children, there were very low expectations. And so it's really all of the issues you're talking about, and of course you have hit on the equity issues and access issues, but unless we actually work on why our children of color, and particularly our poorest children of color, are not getting their basic skills, then all of the other talk about internationalism and access is no longer relevant. And the superintendents are starting to see this. And we do have some great practice beginning where actually people are going into the classes and taking a look at, are there racist practices that are actually keeping our children from learning? We are in a crisis in the United States of our jail. We run juvenile hall at the county office, and our juvenile halls are 99% children of color, maybe 97%. And so I raise that because I think it has to be at the centerpiece, and I want to leave with one area that we've spent a lot of time developing as a way of countering just a focus on testing, and that is the integration of arts throughout the curriculum, because art is a way of communication and of learning, and certainly in diverse places, children can draw on their own cultures and share those cultures, and actually reach out to other nations in very relevant ways. So we're working with the Harvard Project Zero on that issue, and we're trying to research it. But we're looking at it as a way of how do we make sure that our children are all learning, and at the same time, develop the creativity and problem-solving skills that they need.
I'd like to respond to that. One of the things that I think one of the key things that we look at is the fact that who puts this together are the teachers. And if the teachers are not culturally responsive, culturally relevant, we have courageous conversations about race. So we look at what perspective the teacher comes from, because they bring their perspective of how they grew up, where they're from, and that might not be the perspective of all the children sitting in the classroom. And so that is a huge part of making sure that this works, is that you have to have culturally competent not only the staff, but the instruction and the children. And so this is a piece that we have been working on for 7-8 years, and we looked at what is cultural competence and what do we look at when we're doing this. We've had parents of color coming in talking to us about their perspective of how things are, and those are, I absolutely agree with you, this is not going to work unless we know who the audience, who our children are, and that means all the children, so that the teachers see that there are different cultural perspectives on all the different who our constituents are, and those are the children and the parents out there. So I absolutely agree with you that that is the number one most important thing. Otherwise, it doesn't work for everybody.
Can I add another perspective? I think the currently we recognize all the minorities have a lot of, you know, they definitely perform lower on certain skills. But would it be possible that basically when we set up this criteria to say, okay, you have to be good at reading and math, those are certain skills some people are better at, this family is better at, then we tell kids, those kids who are talented in other areas, you are bad in essence. So then, I mean, I think the most important kids lose interest, lose confidence when they come to schools. They feel like they're outcasts anyway, that other talented. What I'm trying to argue, I think there's not new writings come out in this area too, is that actually there's good research even in trying different ways to assess kids' talents cognitively and abilities in different ways. Maybe if we value and begin to value those other talents, they will feel more relevant, because schools in essence is a selection mechanism. Schools is not, and many times we select out kids. We are like gardeners. We decide this is weed and this is good flower. We keep the flower and the weeds get going. I think that's another way to think about this. Again, I know this is not really trendy. My way of thinking, is trying to challenge how we think about various issues. The same way we look across different cultures, different countries. So I think we have to challenge how we define what's a successful student, what's a successful teacher.
Could I just share with you an interesting pilot experiment that may be relevant to your own experience? In the Canadian cities, our big social racial class issue is with Aboriginal students. In my city of Winnipeg, the dropout rate for inner city Aboriginal students is around 60%, sometimes as high as 70%. And it wasn't changing, it was getting worse, and the proliferation of gangs and all the kind of things that go with it. So through our university, we started a partnership, which is, by the way, one of the things we haven't quite talked about, and that is globalization also implies partnership with all kinds of other institutions. It's not just the onus on educators per se. So we started working with the 7 inner city schools at beginning at the grade 4 or 5 level to rewrite, for example, the science curriculum around indigenous science, knowledge that goes back 2,000 years. You can find an awful lot more about climate change by looking how the bugs and the bark are moving than by getting a GPS satellite picture, frankly. I mean, there's a lot of knowledge there that was very, very sort of compatible. And you tie that in with some language and art and history, so that the curriculum, and we have a couple of our education professors working on indigenous science, place entirely, but to be integrated with it. So that began to work pretty nicely. Our students became the mentors, they became involved, set up computer centers, but it still wasn't quite there yet. We were, I think, drawing a lot of kids away from the gangs, and we've got 800 kids enrolled in the programs. Their parents agreed. But the team that was evaluating and getting into it said, something's missing, and there's a tough young guy named Kevin Chief, who was a street kid who came to the university on a basketball scholarship, who is now a teacher, and he said, I'll tell you what it is, they're lacking a touch on the shoulder. And I said, well, what does that mean? They said, well, it's okay to start upgrading the skills and changing the motivation, but the thing that's still lacking is they don't believe it's going to matter in terms of going on to university or college. So what we've done is we opened up, we call an opportunity fund. Every kid who gets enrolled in the program, and there's about 800, we'll set up an account for them. That kid gets involved in developing a community garden. We put $200 into their credit into their account. They get involved in an after-school program, extracurricular program. We give them a $200 credit. They pass their grade 5 science, they get a $200 credit. Each of those students can make up to $5,000 by the time. So they're earning, and their learning is creating an earning. And what we're finding amazing is the parents are now coming in and saying, can we contribute too? And so all of a sudden you've put together a package. Now, it's not finished, it's not evaluated, but it is an effort. And one thing, reason we can do it is we have an infrastructure at the university that the public schools don't have, just in terms of being able to deliver that program and do the research and evaluation working in partnership with them. So we're kind of excited about that hypothesis of saying, is it some way of actually breaking that huge syndrome? Because you're providing not only an alternative stream that is grounded in a knowledge base that is much more natural and indigenous to the kids coming out of that Aboriginal population, but also that they realize their effort is actually going to open the door a little bit for them. And opening that door, it changes the behavior of the teachers, who say, this kid actually has a chance. I mean, this is not a marginal kid. This is a kid who actually has a chance. And it certainly begins to change the attitude of the parents or their guardians. So it's an interesting observation about how you can begin to break that kind of very rigid pattern. So I share that with you just for your information. We have time for a few more before we do some wrap-ups. So.
Hi, my name is Cynthia Lewis, and I'm a retired assistant superintendent from the Surrey School District here in British Columbia, and also a language educator. Dr. Axworthy, I'm from Fort Garry, and the reason I'm a language educator is because of Mrs. Axworthy, who was my French teacher in secondary school. regarding culture, identity, and engagement, we know from our research in immersion programs, language immersion programs, that there's a difference between additive bilingualism and subtractive bilingualism. That is that students need to understand and appreciate who they are and have a grasp of their language and identity before reaching out, and then additive bilingualism is a possible dream. And I think another thing we're learning from the Council of Europe work on language portfolios and teacher education profiles is that, and perhaps this is a selling point for families and for policymakers, is the concept of lifelong learning. Through a lot of the conversation today, really a theme is that teachers need to be lifelong learners, and students need to be lifelong learners, because what they do acquire in the time that they're at in their formal schooling will not suffice for the future. So my question would be, how can we really build on that capacity for lifelong learning, both for the students and the educators? How can we signal that's good important?
Good question. We'd like to tackle that. Lifelong learners.
I think
here?
The one thing, the best way to signal it to kids is we have to be lifelong learners. Learning how to learn is one of the most exciting things in the world. And I think as teachers, it's our job to communicate that by our own interest in learning new things with kids, our willingness to embrace the new tools they have that none of us grew up with, or at least I didn't. You know, we finally got the overhead projector from the bowling alleys. That was technology. Now we have all these other things. We need to learn with them. So, I mean, I think we have huge opportunities, and we need to create some excitement. If we're not excited about it, they're not going to be excited about it. So I think modeling is everything.
Good. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Teresa Tarlos. I'm professor of geography at Orange Coast College in Southern California. And I would like to preface this by saying I was educated both in Europe and the United States, and I'm fluent in 5 languages. What I do in my classes, especially my physical geography, is I teach them a language while I'm teaching geography, because most of the terminology in the 300 words that they need to learn in my course are from German geographers of the 18th and 19th century. So every time I will present a new term, I will also incorporate the German term for it. And at the same time, we also have panels of students who will then go research how is geography taught in other countries in the world. Students love doing this. Up to 8 or 10 of them in a group, they will say, this is how geography is done in Argentina, how it's done in France, how it's done in Thailand, and so forth. So this is my contribution to global education. In addition to that, what I'm very excited about, every second year, I take a group of American students and do a summer school in various places in Europe. Next summer, I'm doing one in Rome, I've done one in Paris, in Florence, etc. And this way, the students are exposed to what I teach in the classroom. So I just wanted to share this with my colleagues and with the panel. Thank you.
That's great. Can we have your geography thing? I know lots of people would like to steal it.
You know, it actually points out something, and I think you said it earlier. There's an opportunity for your organization to actually do a real inventory of best practices that could, just by the sheer sharing of it, add an enormous amount of sort of real fiber to what could be done, because you have chapters throughout North America, other parts of the world, and what I'm hearing very briefly is there's a lot of pretty interesting, exciting things going on, not only what our panel is proposing, but also what you yourself are involved in. That could itself be a major step forward.
I just like to emphasize that. I think, I described when I started talking to people at the national level about this, they were sort of skeptical that it was an issue that they should take. They're not, that's not there anymore. I know it is in certain parts of the country. I think the question has changed from whether we should teach about the world to how to teach about the world, mm-hmm. given everything else we have to do. So I think this inventory of best practices idea, that's the reason for showcasing certain schools, but I also think within each discipline to inventory things that are already going on that other people can copy would be tremendous.
Also, Lloyd, I think the I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, but Teresa, you know, you were asking about what teacher education colleges should do, faculty mm-hmm. of education. Yeah. They should study teachers like her, like Teresa first. To, say, to summarize, seriously, the talents, the qualification you have, then say how can we prepare every teacher to do the same thing. I mean, imagine your five languages, your background, mm-hmm. how many teachers has that background to become so creative, how many of them are aware of other things, but how do our teacher education programs learn from you mm-hmm. to develop their talents because you will be the model teacher. So I'm going to get your name and I'm talking to our dean. Maybe we'll be building something like this.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Can I say just a word about who's stepping up to the mic right now? It's Nancy Kaplan. Now I'll embarrass her. This is who I spoke about the international newspaper. She is the creative mind behind getting that going. So, Nancy, I hope you'll thank you for letting us have that great example to look at.
And I'm nervous to speak on a microphone, too. I'm Nancy Kaplan, and I teach at International School on Staten Island in New York. And with all the talk of technology, I just wanted to say that I think it's something that has to be a seamless aspect of global education or an internationalized curriculum. So when you were talking about the experiences that students have with students abroad, I think the way it really needs to be done is, you know, having them do some kind of internet blogging or Skyping, whatever it may be, teleconferencing before, and maybe do some collaborative work then. And then when they meet, initially, I don't remember who it was on the panel that said, you know, I think one person spoke about a child soldier and from Sierra Leone, and when they initially meet, how they just are talking socially. And this is something that actually happened last year between a child soldier from Sierra Leone and my own child. Mm-hmm. When he came to the house, he just was a beeline to my son. And they were just talking about video gaming. And mm-hmm. to my dismay, they were playing a violent video game. But since then, this child is working with my students to report for the international newspaper. So I think it's the job of the teacher then to focus that sort of initial social interaction into something that, you know, could fit into our curriculum, into some kind of meaningful experience. And at our school, we've had students from Bahrain who came, and yes, the first thing they do is realize how similar they are and on a social level, but then the teacher can focus that and have them do work that is, you know, part of our curriculum. And then after a meeting with students from abroad, this kind of connection could continue, again, through technology, once the students have maybe left your school, where they can continue collaborating through projects that, again, go through Skyping or blogging, forums, and anytime I meet anybody from another country, that's how I build my international reporter base, and these kids continue to report for me ongoing. In fact, Sherry mentioned the boy from Saudi Arabia who had we lost him off the radar for quite a while, but I just heard from him 2 weeks ago, so you just have to keep the connections going. And in fact, I've turned the whole thing over to one of my students who's now going to be the international editor for the paper. So something that you put in the hands of the students, they know how to connect with technology. And I think the teacher's job is just to help them focus that connection and continue it. So that's all. Good. I have to say.
Thank you very much, Nancy.
I just love to extend on what Nancy said, which is about how do we use those learning experiences as leadership development experiences for our students, whether through the international newspaper, through Model United Nations, through service learning initiatives. How do we build their capacity as leaders as well in that context? So, Nancy, I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Hello. My name is Dr. Rendell Drew. I'm a full-time professor at Orange Coast College of Political Science, History, with my esteemed colleague, Dr. Therese Tarlos, representing California. Okay. Okay. A couple of things. I'm so glad that I came to this conference today because one of the main things that I'm here to find out is how is this piece of legislation really working with the No Child Left Behind after they get out of the secondary, the primary, secondary, and then they come to our level in higher education. Because I'm here to tell you guys, when I have my students do written reports, I spend more time, you know, on correcting the grammar, the sentence structure, capitalization. Should I keep going? Okay. So I'm wondering, you know, how effective is this No Child Left Behind? Because it seems to me they're sure getting left behind when they get to the higher education levels. You know, and so one thing that I'm here to find out is, what is our role at the higher education levels, and what happens, you know, to after they get through that primary, secondary level, and what can we do to help improve that? Also, I think that in reference to one of the comments that were made by the lady, Sherry, is it? Sheila. Well, Sheila. Thank you, Sheila. That is one of my concerns as well, because with the new legislation of the No Child Left Behind, the issues of globalization and stuff, I'm a proponent of it, but I'm also a proponent on helping our own inner city children and helping, you know, to come to some kind of viable solutions to help better educate them and getting them through the system, because it seems like there's more of a focus on a more global approach as opposed to the inner city approach. And while at the same time it's a noble, wonderful effort, and yes, I do support it, just to be clear, but I'm also here to support the many different ethnic minority students who are coming through, who are not getting the attention, who are not getting the programs, not getting the help that they need. And we're also the state in California where we have people who sometimes march for rights, even though they're not citizens. So once again, we are all open to this thing, and we want to bring people in. And I take my time as an instructor, but I'm really here to get some of this provincial wisdom from all you intelligent folks to help me at the higher education level. And, you know, where do we go from here? Are there any initiatives in the works, for example? How do we go? What do we do? You guys are giving them to us after high school. They need to learn how to write a sentence.
Well, for those of us who have lived our lives in high schools a long time, we believe that something happens when we give them a diploma, that all knowledge flows out of them before they get to you all in higher ed.
So
we hear that. We also, like, we blame elementary and middle school too. Like, they didn't teach them anything. Neither, I mean, you know, it's just it's a whole kind of systemic issue.
Yes.
I think around that. I guess I want to go back to thinking about what our network is doing, which is working with in inner city communities or in rural communities with disadvantaged, primarily minority students who have been traditionally underserved. And so, and I also want to go back and address this notion of, you know, trying to close the achievement gap, particularly in literacy and numeracy, which is at the heart of No Child Left Behind. I guess my comment to that would be is, literacy and numeracy for what? And that it is that we can certainly contextualize literacy and numeracy with broader global understandings to not further widen the gap, right? So you remember a few years ago, we went through in public schools, we stopped calling it remedial education and we began calling it acceleration, which we understood, which actually philosophically I could agree with, because we needed kids to learn more faster to close that achievement gap. And so So where we're wrestling with is, how do we take what we know are those base level literacy and numeracy skills and accelerate students' learning around those while not holding them back in a remedial model, while contextualizing it? For example, we've written a literacy course that we are pilot testing this year that uses the content of globalization and global studies to teach those base level literacy skills and reinforce those with kids. And frankly, go back exactly what you were talking about, is to try to help kids rewrite their academic story and the story that they're telling themselves about what they are as a learner. Because I do think our schools oftentimes destroy that sense of confidence in learning. And so those are the kinds of pieces we're trying to intentionally build in the curriculum we're working with in the schools, because in our settings, that's just an imperative that we bring to it. I wish I had a great answer for you in that regard, other than we believe that the students we're working with, that's essential to their schooling, to both do the skill development along with giving them the tools they need for the global
stage. But I think the No Child Behind action is using numeracy and literacy as an excuse to further disadvantage minority kids. Mm-hmm. I really think that's a big mistake. All educators here should take take action on it. Because I'm really angry when I get this idea. Because if we are, in essence, what we're doing now, we are in the excuse of saying, these kids, you have to meet this, become proficient in math and reading, therefore you cannot do other things.
Right. Right.
If you look at the program, the 76% of schools that dropped other programs, most of them are minority inner city schools.
Right.
And now when the urban suburban kids are traveling to China, engaging to in foreign languages, the other kids are actually being held back. It's the same thing happened in computers. You know, when the inner city kids are using computers as tutors, the suburban kids are using them to design new wonderful things. So that's I think, what we need to do. We should not take the excuse. We should not bow to this action. I mean, I'm really getting very emotional about No Child Behind. I think CAP, and again, you've done a wonderful job to discredit a lot of the arguments. I mean, again, if you look at most of things, I think that's why we should become activists to every person. I mean, now you live in California, you can put so many movie actors as governors. Can do anything.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
There's the ultimate answer for you.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
I'm just conscious of the clock and the fact that you have other sort of demands on your time. So I'm sorry for a couple, but I'm going to accept one more comment from the mic. And if there are any panel members and then want to sort of lace a few remarks, and then we can go off for our break. So, yes, sir.
I'm Robert Liesma, long involved in many aspects of international and global education, but retired for now. I'd like to squeeze in 4 points in 2 or 3 minutes, beginning with a commendation for PDK International and the development of this seminar. I think this session this afternoon has been a very interesting and fruitful point of departure for all the good sessions you've got scheduled in the next 2 days. My first point beyond that is very simply that in many of the interesting things that have been said and examples given, there are some interesting historical antecedents which contribute in a number of ways to some of the things that you have in process and some of the things that you've done. I would like to see PDK, and here I skip really to what was going to be my concluding sentence. I would hope when this conference is over that PDK would find ways to seriously consider how they can carry on the dialogue, the networks, everything else, because we don't want to lose this as we've lost so many earlier opportunities to not build on what we know or maybe what folks who came before may know and contribute. But substantively, I'd like to focus on one thing and then leave you with a quote. The particular issue I would focus on very quickly is teacher education. It's come up over and over again. It, I'm pleased to see, is in the program for 2 or 3 different sessions. The fact of the matter is it is central. It is central to all of the things we know it is in teacher education, in education. And on this point, I feel compelled, because of a lot of firsthand contact with the person I'm going to laud. He's gone now. But in the States, as many of you know, there is a professional organization called, long and miserable title and acronym, the American Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, which is made up of the majority of teacher education programs in the university, whether or not they're departments, schools, faculties, or just program. And for many years, the person in charge of international activities for AACTE, the acronym, was Frank Clausen. I'm pleased to say a native Canadian who greatly enriched the American experience. And Clausen did many of the things he did, obviously not single-handedly, but a very creative mind, a very good organizer, but through an international organization called something like, and here my memory fails me a bit, I think, the International Council for Education of Teachers. ICET is what I recall, but I may have the wrong organization. So this is not an ethnocentric comment. One of the many things that Frank made possible through AACTE was the development of a book about the importance of international matters to teacher education. And this would have been published circa the late 60s. And that's where my quote comes from. The author of the book, still through the wisdom of somebody who was at the time very well known, and very well known not for education per se, as sometimes we think of it, but in a broader sense, he was a visionary. Harold Taylor, whom you may know, president of a small, very progressive college in New England, and various other things. Taylor, in that book, and in subsequent conferences, where he spoke on the role of the teacher in international education, but it is a philosophy and a concept that applies across the board. Taylor said, you could visualize him talking to a bunch of deans or to school board members or chief state school officers, and he would get exercised by it. He would say, what you people must understand is that teachers don't come out of the curriculum. The curriculum comes out of teachers. Okay. International. Good. If we don't get teachers involved.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm very sorry that we have to bring the session to an end. I think, as the last intervener just said, I think this has opened up an important dialogue. You do have a couple more days to sort of roll it around a little bit. I looked at the program and found out that sometime tomorrow morning I have to give you a summary.
Good luck.
I hope martinis are on the menu for tonight so I can brew a proper concoction along the way. Let me really say that I really enjoyed being a member of this panel or helping to moderate it. They've been extremely well-behaved and extremely well-informed. Before John closes, I want to make a plug. Many of you are our guests here, and you heard from our colleague from Alberta what is the great Canadian lament, that if you're going to do international studies, remember that your neighbors north of the border are international. One of the things I just tell you a very small anecdote. When I was in the federal government, our prime minister was out to take a speaking tour in the United States, and he asked our Foreign Affairs Department if we'd do some surveying amongst Americans as to what they knew about Canada, particularly who they thought important Canadians were. And so I kind of deferred doing it, and I got the results, and I tried to bury it in the desk, and he kept nudging me to say, well, what did you find out? But who do the Americans know best about Canada? And I said, well, Prime Minister, you know, it's not ready yet. And he said, look, do you want your job or not? Give me the answer. So I finally had to tell him that the best-known Canadian was Pamela Lee Anderson. The reason being, of course, that the Americans see more of her than any other Canadian. So just recall that we are sort of a part of that broad global education that you're talking about. Thank you very much.
That's good.
Lloyd and panel members, thank you so much. Let's thank them just one more time, folks. I know, I thought it was some incredible, stimulating conversations and questions.
Yeah.
That really made me think about some things I can do as an administrator in my district, in my building, dialogue that maybe I can start stimulating with teachers, parents. So I appreciate it from a personal point of view. So I thank you, and I thank the audience and the questions. I have some important information to give you. It's still raining. I went back to my seat after I made introductions, and I said, rain, rain, go away, come again another day, 100 times. It doesn't work. But all joking aside, we will have a summit report written by Aaron Young, PDK's Director of Publications and New Media, and that'll be published in the January happen. The article will highlight not only this discussion, but other discussions that take place over the conference, so I would encourage you to get actively involved in each of the discussions and dialogue. For those of you who are CMLs and chapter officers, your meeting begins almost promptly at 3. I know we're at 3 now, so I'd like to say take 5 minutes and no longer, and then let's meet. And I would just remind everyone that we look forward to seeing you this evening, 6 o'clock in Salon D&E, for our welcome reception. So thank you again.